Alrighty. In my recent experience as a clinical specialist, I had the pleasure of being in a lot of ICU units and looking at a lot of ECMO difficulties they were having. And I was kind of surprised to see how variable some of their assessments were. Some were impressively aggressive, some lesser so. But the bare question we get down to is the amount of clot in an oxygenator has traditionally just been impossible to determine. And I thought I'd go over a few of the things that we use currently that help us to find out just how much there is. Next slide. Joe, I think he has control of the slides, right?
Yes, yeah. It just takes a second for you to see it.
All right.
You have it?
I'm not seeing what you're seeing on the screen.
Ah, what's going on, guys? Hold on. Time out, everybody. Oh, he exited out of it. Oh, let me call him. Oh, here. Oh, okay. We'll call him. That was for a special event, not a lifetime. There we go. Hey, Roger, welcome back.
All right, sorry about that.
That's okay. I think there may be some reason you should be able to see the slides because they're up now.
All right, I'll do my best with what I can see. It's kind of small.
Well, wait, David can help you make them big.
I got it. That's okay. All righty. Let's start back at the beginning, going through some of the coagulation difficulties. In perfusion school, we learned all about the different, about the coagulation tree, intrinsic, extrinsic, common, all the elements within. Next slide. And with that, all the anticoagulants and how they involve the different levels, the different steps. Next slide. And on to the propagation phases, et cetera, et cetera. We learned all about the cascade, but we weren't given many tools on evaluating how much we've gotten. Go ahead, next slide. Everyone measures different amounts of more or less of the different blood gases. Everyone's using ACTs and PT. PTTs largely replaced with APTTs. Some use the anti-factor 10. Thromboelastographs, rotational thromboelastometry. Both of those are still kind of hotly debated in some places. The AT3 levels, fibrinogen with how many strands of fibers we're getting, the D-dimer showing how many strand pieces are breaking up. All of them can be useful in their own way to show the propensity and the degree, but none of them have any clue as to the volumes we've got within the upper. Within the circuit, within the oxygenator. Next slide. All right, so what are the problems we're facing on ECMO? Well, let's start with the basic anticoagulation we all understand. The CPB is not handled the same as ECMO. Next slide. In the early 60s, we determined the heparin dose response curve, and you can see the ACT here versus the percent of effectiveness at the different levels of heparin. Next slide. At a level of about 300 will effectively anticoagulate about well over 90% of the population. The safety factors were added to that of 33 and 60%. Next slide. And showing here the at 60% over top of the other number, that's where the common number of 480 comes from. It's nothing more scientific than that. Next slide. But in the world of ECMO, similar to the cath lab, we're dealing with ACTs of 180 to 200. The cath lab, you get away with it. You've got a wire. It's in place for an hour. But on ECMO, you're in there for weeks, if not months. So we're virtually assuring that there's going to be clot constantly growing within all of the patients. Next slide. All right. The rates vary. There's no consistency. I've seen oxygenators get changed out within 3 days. I've heard of them getting changed out within one. Some people go a month or more without any change outs at all. So there's real no good determinable rate that we can even predict that they're going to clot. Next. All right. Additionally, you can only see clot within a few millimeters of the plastic, and even then, only if it's a different color. There's you can't tell if there's any inside the fibers, and you can't even really see even large ones if they're under the plastic, and the color is the same. Next. So there's really no reliable assay available that we can say, okay, that's enough clot. We need to do something. So with all that in mind, next slide. The question is, how do we know when an oxygenator should be changed out? And that's a big problem. Like I said, I've seen a lot of places that don't use nearly all the tools that are available, but they all seem to do a pretty good job or not. We'll talk about that in a second. Next. So let's briefly go over all the things that I know of today that we could possibly use and are being used to determine what amount of clot you're getting in the oxygenator. I'm not addressing the circuit specifically because clot traditionally isn't found in the circuit, possibly around the rims of some of the fittings, the connectors, but the clots are generally the largest amount is where the flow is slowest and there's a lot of surface area to grab onto, and that's going to be in the fibers of the oxygenator. The first thing we use, and it's a lot of fun, you darken the room and you get on your knees and you hunt around with an oblique light with a flashlight. Next slide. Really sharp-eyed people get down in there close and they can try and see if there's any clots, anything moving, anything holding still. Next slide. In this one, there's a tiny little amount. There's five different flecks that you can barely see. Okay, I see the flecks. Now what do I do with that information? Not very quantitative. Next. All right. Coagulation testing, we've already discussed. You have the whole realm of testing that can be done. Next slide. These are the same list that we showed before. They're all valuable in their own way, used at different times by different intensivists, preferred at different institutions. But again, none of them relate to the volume that's lying within the oxygenator. Next. Pressure differential. By that, I'm talking about the pressure pre and post oxygenator. Universally, if you only do one test, this is the one. The idea of this is as clot grows, resistance grows, and the pressure will grow. And if the pressure grows enough, you change out the oxygenator. Unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence kind of condemning this process. Next. Next. All right, here's an oxygenator that was rinsed out, and it had a nice layer of soft clot. The oxygenators will be talking to some apologies to McKay. Generally, they produce some pretty good equipment, but well over 95% of all the ECMO units are using the Quadrox, one of the models of Quadrox. So we'll be discussing this one primarily, but the problems I'm discussing also are pertinent with cylindrical oxygenators. But let's have fun with the Quadrox here. Here's a nice soft clot that's growing universally across the face. And that's the assumption that is generally made. They say, well, if the clot grows uniformly across the face, the pressure will rise in a linear fashion, and I'll get a pretty predictable number with high reliability of how much clot I have. Next picture. This is a little more common. This is a lot more common. The Quadrox has corners. Any engineer that decided to put corners on a hydrodynamic system, in this case hemodynamic system, must have been banging his fist on the table saying, guys, we can't do that. At least I hope they did, because there's no rationale for corners. And this would be a good reason why. The flow is inevitably going to be slower in the corners, and this is a pretty typical shot where you've got some well-developed clot in the corners, and it varies throughout the face. Next slide. You can also see a small portion here with fairly wide open fibers. These act much like a leak in any system, and the pressures will be deceptively lower. They won't rise if you even have a small field of open fibers. Next one. All right, here you have something that looked very nice on the upstream side, but somewhere inside there's a large amount of clots that were growing through the fibers, and you can see the mature nodules, if you will, that were growing until the flow had enough surface area to block, to knock it off, and then onto the patient it goes. Also with this, you can notice a lot of wide open fiber fields. There's no upstream indicator pressure-wise that this would be a problem. Next one. This is a nightmare situation. You've got a huge amount of mature clot, like the last one. This is the downstream side of the oxygenator. Wide open fields of nice fresh fibers. There's no upstream indication that there's any problem. Downstream, you've got a mountain of clot that's growing and breaking and sloughing off. And the case report that came with this, I was told that the baby died in a little over a week from a stroke on VA ECMO. Next picture. All right, this is kind of easy to understand if you look at the basic pressure flow curves that we've seen. The Reed curve shows the amount of increasing blockage across the bottom from 0 to 100. And yet the red line will show you that the flow will remain fine up to about 70-75%. And that's not coincidentally why cath labs don't refer lesions for surgery until they're about that high, because you can sustain 100% flow through lesions that large. Next picture. So you got a lot of a drop in that later period. And this is inversely, the flow is inversely proportional to pressure. So you would have a mirror image steep incline only as a late sign in the oxygenator.
It's completely dead. Good. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're back on face block. Let me see.
We're back on face block? Okay, good. You're getting as bad as me. All right, but are we on the tweeter?
Give me a second.
Okay, don't forget, turn your camera back on, Roger. Everybody laughs at me when I call it the tweeter. They keep trying to convince me it's Twitter, but that would mean that you send Twitters. You'd send tweets. You don't send twits.
Oh, jeez.
Right? Doesn't that make sense?
It makes sense. Yeah, it's not correct.
It doesn't matter. It's correct
it
to
makes
me.
Sense.
Hey,
it's
we're back
correct.
Up. Okay.
Oh, not yet.
No, not yet. We're not quite yet. Not quite there. We have to go. Now we have to go live.
Yes, we are live.
We're live. Okay. Welcome back, everyone. And please forgive us. We had just a minor technical difficulty, but it's all been fixed by the expert broadcasting crew over there. So we're good now. Roger, please forgive us for the interruption. Continue.
I've got a glitch at my end now.
No, that doesn't.
Yeah. You guys are like a still shot. I'm not getting that.
Oh, we see you. You're perfect. And we see your slides.
Mm. We have one the last.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you back up one, that'd be better. I don't have a live shot of you. I just get a still shot. I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah, that's okay. Don't worry about that.
Well, I need it before I can see the slides.
Oh, you need us. Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't know you couldn't see the slides.
All right. Nothing is working here. I'm going to hang up and call. Can you call back on Skype?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
How you been, Mike? I haven't seen you for a while.
I'm right there. I'm getting close.
What? But it wasn't the first. Yeah, I'd like to hear about that. Not while on the internet. Yeah. I think we're live. Mm. We're still live.
What's up? What's happening?
He didn't pick up.
He's not picking up.
I'll
try again.
Da 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 da.
Da da da.
Hmm. I mean, just call him on his phone and tell him. Can you just talk to him and just tell him what to do?
Oh, really?
Are we online?
Is tomorrow the last day?
Oh, okay. Well, go to a wide shot of us. Hey, everybody. Okay, so we're just having some technical difficulties, and you know, it's part of this process. I wish it was easier, and I wish these things didn't happen, but they do. But we're here where we are. So let's see. I guess what can we do? Patrick, tell us about your case today. What'd you do?
It was a pretty straightforward case. It was a three vessel bypass with Mark Matoyer, who we work with all the time, and it was easy. Mm-hmm. It was a good day. But then there was several other emergencies around town, and so what happened is during the second, I had to do part of the second case, which was fine, you know, not what I expected, but it was fun to help out in a tough situation.
Good, excellent. Hey, how did your case go the other day, that high-risk case in the cath lab where they were doing ECMO standby? Actually, we're back? Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
Listen, don't worry about it. It's okay.
All right. You want to back up one slide, and then we'll go forward? Right there. Okay, yeah, the next one. Forward. All right. We'll start from there, Joe.
All right, that sounds perfect. We're ready.
Okay. Across the bottom, you can see the percent of occlusion. This would be true whether it's a vessel, an oxygenator, anything. A garden hose, it doesn't matter. The red line shows the performance of flow as the occlusion increases. And you only have a steep falling off once you get up around the 75-80% range. Next picture. This late end would also be inversely proportional to the occlusion you would see, the pressure you would see upstream from the oxygenator. So by the time you do see an upstream pressure rise, often you've got way too much clot to handle. The first time I was made to realize this by washing out oxygenators and looking at them, I was pretty taken aback. So my reaction was kind of the same as a lot of perfusionists when they see this. Mm-hmm. Next picture.
Well, this got my attention.
Yeah, it's about right. Mm-hmm. Next picture. All right. The fourth method here is dilution measurement. Next picture. It's a device that I was familiar with. It has an arterial and venous sensor. Same flow sensors that are on the majority of heart-lung machines around the country. The difference with this is a regular sensor can measure instantaneous flow. This monitor totalizes. It'll take a time run and give you the amount of volume between time A and time B. Next picture. All right, and here's the injection port, and it's just a room temperature saline upstream and the arterial sensor just downstream from the oxygenator.
Oh, thank you.
Right? Next picture. Well, not next picture. Make it run. Here you can see the injection of saline. It moves through. Now the sensor senses the increase of speed, and that's time zero. The saline bolus moves through the oxygenator, through the line, and as soon as it crosses into the arterial sensor, then it takes the mean of that. So it knows the time between those two points, and it knows the total flow between those two points. Therefore, between the syringe and the sensor, it knows that volume. And as time goes on and clot grows, volume decreases. It's kind of a low-tech solution, but it's a really good application. Of interest here, also, since there's a venous sensor, it can also track if you're on VV ECMO, say you've got the saline bolus moves into the patient, whatever percent of that bolus comes immediately out of the patient would also be recorded, and you can figure out the recirculation from that immediately and accurately. Any of you have had intensivists scratching their heads desperately trying to decide if they got to return a patient to an OR or let them be, or move the cannulas again, can realize this is it's a very frustrating situation. Same device, just two different uses of it. Next picture. All right, the first spike is the bolus, the increase of speed, that's time zero. Next. And then the waveform, that's the saline bolus as it passes through the sensor. All right, next shot. All right, and then you can read directly the oxygenator volume, both percentage and total CCs. So pretty useful, usable bedside. You can move it to different patients. It's there's no other way to get a direct measurement. Next picture. It's one problem with it is it's only a snapshot. Each time you make an injection, it takes one point, but it will trend over time. Here you can see in time, I think it's in the 80-hour range, the oxygenator was failing, and they replaced it, and that brought it up to baseline. Mm. Next shot. All right. The next one is one I accidentally stumbled across. This is measuring the CO2 output in an oxygenator. Go ahead. There's a Dr. Kessler from Aachen, Germany, wanted to do a study where he correlated how much clot in an oxygenator would correlate with some other factors, the pre and post pressures being one, and also some CO2. This is a new paper, January this year. Next slide. What he did was he took several quadroxes, he drilled little holes in the corner where clot is most likely, and he filled it up with varying amounts of silicone, I think 30, 40, 50, 65, and 85 cc's. And in the bottom, then what he did is he took a CT scan of each one. Now, silicones, it's more cohesive and adhesive than a blood clot. Blood clot would have more of a diffuse, more with more tentacles, fiber shapes, etc. However, the point would be this in a single lump form, you can see pretty readily that some of these percentages can show a lot of clot within the fibers and not even be visible. If we took just the fourth one, the 65 cc one, and looked at that, next slide. 65 cc's is 30% of 215 cc's, so 30% of this oxygenator is full of clot. Assuming there's blood going through, you would see from the face how little is visible, if at all, in the lower corner. On cross-section, you can see most of the clots inside the oxygenator, so that wouldn't be visible at all downstream, and however small amount upstream. Next. These are the curves, the results. The upper curve is 5 liters per minute flow, middle curve is 2.5 liters, and the lower curve is half a liter, more of a typical pediatric flow. If we look at the 65 cc point, go ahead, we can see that the curves are all pretty well flat right up to that point. At 5 liters of flow, you will start to see it. After the oxygenator is a third full, you will start to see some damming and some upstream pressures jumping. Middle flow a little bit. Troubling to the pediatric perfusionist here, if you're running 500 cc's in this case, even beyond that to the 85 and beyond, you're not going to see a rise in pressure upstream. So the late sign won't occur until significantly later. Next. And next. One curve that he did have on this paper, but for some reason, he doesn't really explain why, he put a CO2 monitor on the gas output of the oxygenator. I had a discussion with Joe earlier about this. The one remarkable thing is all three flow rates, they're all fairly linear. They don't vary very much. There's a little hump in the middle. But for single tests like he did, he came up with some pretty linear numbers. Counterintuitive is CO2 drops. Joe and I had a discussion about this and shared the idea that, sure enough, the CO2 would climb within the patient, but very likely would drop on the exit ramp on the oxygenator. The point being, if you could monitor the CO2 output on an oxygenator, and any respiratory therapist can grab you a simple, cheap monitor to be able to do that, that may be a usable method to measure the clot. You'd have to determine, you'd have to parallel it with something effective, bench tests, etc. But once you had those numbers in hand, this might become an effective thing. So if you have any perfusion students or fellows that are looking for good things to do a study on, this might be a good inexpensive one to do. Next. All right, the last one is a transcranial Doppler. Next. I went to Johns Hopkins. They have a very talented neuroscience guy, a stroke guy, who's got, I think he's 26, 28 papers. He's done 2 years of a fellowship at Cleveland Clinic, and he's been at Hopkins about 2.5 years, Dr. Cho. This paper, actually more of a case study, came out in January of this year. He's been looking at strokes for all different types of invasive procedures. Recently, he's done papers on TAVRs and VADs with a positive correlation with an increase of microembolic signals with the increasing duration of the ECMO of the procedures. In this case, they had a heart transplant patient who wasn't doing well. They put him on ECMO. Next slide. And the upper screen is from the measurement he did the night that they were having trouble. The next day, they replaced the oxygenator, and that was the second test he got. So clearly, that's what you would expect. So anything outside of that, certainly not a welcome thing in your brain. We tend to deal a lot with just tubings and circuits and pressures and flows, but we don't directly address, other than the NIRS, which some people call a random number generator, we don't really look at functions perfusion-wise in the brain.
That's true.
I thought this is a pretty smart thing to be able to do, because after all, it's what we're trying to do the most, is protect not just the patient's organs, but most importantly, the brain. And this reading is taken right off the middle cerebral artery, so he's getting quite accurate information that something's going on there. So are we doing the right thing by anticoagulating patients or trading possible cerebral hemorrhaging for known cerebral microemboli? Is our tipping point at 180 to 200 seconds a good one? The jury's still out, but studies like this will go a long way to making some headway for it. Next slide. So those are all the tests kind of rounded up. The flashlight test, a lot of fun to do, but not much use. The coagulation, well, that's going to continue to be used because it does give a lot of indicators for other things, but not so much for clotting. The pressure differential,
putting the Grigri on me. I think she might be mad because I was upset. Because
somewhere hitting her, damn it, doll.
Facebook is live. Hi, everybody on Facebook. We're having, again, technical difficulties. I'd like to blame it on weather, but I can't. I'd like to blame it on I'm just so good looking that the machine can't handle it, but I guess I can't really do that either. We can blame it on Patrick because he was late. That's always suitable. Somebody's got to take the fall, dude. I like your yellow tie. It's very pretty.
Do you know what this is?
I can't see from
it's,
here.
It's termite season. Termites. And you being from the area that you live.
Yeah, we have a lot of termites in Louisiana.
They fly out in the summer this time of year.
Yeah.
And then they, if they land in water and near wood, I guess they make a new queen.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
wow.
Anyway, I've got a story behind that. You want to hear?
Sure.
Just wasting
sure.
time. All right. So when I lived in New Orleans, and oh, by the way, they told us when we moved into the neighborhood, they said, that day when this all happens, when the humidity is perfect and the, you know, the temperature is right and these things start swarming out, turn off every light in your house, even your clock radio. Don't even have a clock on. Like, it's got to be dark because these things are so attracted to light, they're going to come into your house. It's going to be terrible. So just do that. So the night that that happened, we did that, and then I was going for a walk, and there was a tourist who was wearing these beads that were flashing and
yeah.
lighting, and these moths were like, these termites were like all over this person. They're going, what is with these moths? And I decided, you know, I'll just let them go ahead and deal with that. So like,
that was
I didn't
mean,
tell
dude.
Them to turn the lights off.
That was not nice, okay?
You know, sometimes the tourists in New Orleans aren't
so come on. You were a tourist once.
Yeah, once. And then okay. I lived there.
Yeah. But you were at least a tourist for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you first lived there, first moved there.
Yeah.
So how are we looking?
We're alive.
We're live again? We're back up?
Oh, okay. Everybody heard that story?
Hey, so now we got to get his slides up. And we're...
I think he's just on the last slide.
I know.
Yeah.
And let's try to just hope we get through it now. And maybe don't go to LinkedIn. I still think you ought to try not to. And this could be the tweeter. I think this is a conspiracy.
You're going to blame it on the tweeter?
Yeah. I think this is a conspiracy.
This is all of Donald Trump.
I think I think this is perfusion.com is sabotaging us somehow. I think they're hacking in. Have you gotten cooling the room down more?
Maybe.
Yeah.
We're up.
We're up. Okay. All right. Roger, go ahead. We need to call that Michael Chen guy that has the cyber war. I think that's what's wrong. The Chinese have hacked us.
Oh, no. All right. Well, to summarize, we already talked about the flashlight test and how much fun that is, and coagulation testing, which will continue, neither of which are very quantitative. The pressure differential, I'm sure, will continue to be used and trusted by most people, but it's horribly misleading. I would advise anybody doing this to start cutting the oxygenator out of the circuit before they trash it and rinse it out. I think you'd be pretty surprised at the variability of patterns. It's incredible when you first see the first view. Fourth, a dilution measurement. It's accurate. It's effective. It's a snapshot. You need to run it as a trend every 4, 8, 12, however many hours, but it is useful. The oxygenator CO2 output, well, the jury's still out on that. It will require a good study or two, but that might be something within arm's reach that would also be useful to anybody. And the transcranial Doppler, I'm excited about that. Hopkins is paying full attention. They've got a full-blown study going on that now. So that's I expect that to turn into a pretty interesting research paper within the next year or so. And that's pretty much all we have. Next slide. If any questions you have, I'd be glad to entertain them.
I'm going to give you applause on that.
Yeah.
Because despite all of the technical difficulties, and I know that was challenging, can we see him as well on the screen? There he goes. I just thought it was a great talk, and I feel bad, frankly, that it had those issues, because it is a great talk. Mm-hmm. And we feel like you didn't do you good justice there. And probably the best thing to do is to invite you back and have you come to the studio and do it from here. We seem to have fewer complications when we do that. It always seems to have a problem when we're doing these, even though we think we have all the technology in the world. But be that as it may, I have a bunch of questions, but I'm going to defer over to Tammy because she was writing prolifically over here. So let's go with some of your questions. Everybody's got a call. The phone's open. So if somebody wants to call in, we'll go ahead and put the phone lines up and we'll let them call in and I can answer the call. Be patient, though, because I might have to put you on hold till we're ready to talk to you. So go ahead.
Okay. So I have a couple questions. First off, I'm really interested in this dilution measurement. Have you had an opportunity to use that type of thing, or is it just something that you've read about?
Well, until recently, I was working with that at Transonic.
Okay.
So I've seen it bench tested. It's really accurate. It's a good device.
Is that its main purpose? That's why it was created?
Yes. Yeah, there's a research scientist there that's taken the flow measurement sensors and moved them one generation farther into being able to totalize the volume. The interesting thing is we have dilution theory before from things like Swan-Ganz catheters, but dilution isn't very good. It's not thorough. And even though a thermistor reacts quickly, the transit time through the lungs is too fast. So that's why Swan-Ganz catheters can kind of give dilution a bad name. They can be 20, 30, 40% inaccurate. And physicians know this, but it's what they've used, it's what they know, it's what they have. The dilution this uses, the fluid mixes very quickly, and saline is a largely different wavelength than blood. So it reads it pretty accurately. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really promising technology. And it seems like it's smaller type device that really could be used for a great safety for ECMO. There's not a lot of safety devices that really provide useful information.
Yeah, our air sensors aren't going to pick it up.
Right.
You can have an air sensor on there, and you know that's only going to protect you from air. Mm-hmm. You know. So, Roger, I like that you talked about that. You mind if I add to the question?
Please.
And my interest in it is more in the recirculation problem with the cannula.
That's.
And you kind of went over it, but can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I've got a similar but separate talk on completely on the recirculation aspect. There's been some good papers showing just minor adjustments with most places are using Avalon or Origin catheters. It's a 2-in-1, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dual lumen.
Or the Crescent one, now.
Or the Crescent.
The Crescent's new, they actually used this device to bench test it in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But the Crescent is longer, and they brag about it not being any recirculation, but that's because it's like inches different from the ports, and they feed it up through the valve. And the problem I see with those is it causes a lot of abrasion on the valve. Yeah, it's going right through into the pulmonary artery.
No, you're talking about the tandem heart. That's the Protek Duo. The Crescent is basically the same as the Avalon. It's just, so I guess their patent must have run out. I don't know, but it's a dual lumen that goes into the IVC. So it goes through the IJ, or some people are putting it in the left subclavian and putting it all the way down that way. So it's not the one that goes into the pulmonary artery.
Oh, okay. There's a new one by Medtronic's carrying it for MC3 Labs. That's Bob Bartlett's group. That's the one I thought you meant. The only two that I've seen are the Origin and the Avalon. And the problem with them, if you ever get them in your hands, most places use it, even though it's more expensive. They're several hundred dollars. But the average pediatric ECMO case runs over $300,000. So
yeah.
There's a lot more money available to those groups than there are in cardiac surgery. They got to beg and borrow for the least little thing because the money has drifted over to the cath labs. But in ECMO, they generally can get more that they need. Mm. The problem with those dual lumen catheters is if you ever get them in your hand, the proximal and the distal ports are millimeters apart. Mm-hmm. And if you don't place it perfectly, there's six sizes of the Avalon, seven of the Origin, or vice versa. There's a million sizes of patients. Mm-hmm. And if the anatomy isn't just right, or they put it a little too far, a little too close, there's a lot of trouble with it spinning around in the atrium until it goes back into the point of least resistance is the distal ports, where it's going to suck it all back into the circuit without the body being able to use it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you have that talk now? I'd almost rather you gave that talk than me give mine, but I'll give mine if you got to promise you're going to give that talk, because I have a real interest in this.
If you want to, I'd be glad to. Sure.
I'd love for you to. No, seriously, if you want to give it now, you can give it now.
I don't have it on the computer right now.
Okay, all right, but I mean that'd be fine with us. So, but that's where my real interest lies. I noticed you said that the percent of occlusion, for measuring pressures, because I'm not an advocate of measuring pressures. I'm not an advocate of having a manifold. I'm not an advocate of any of that stuff. But for different reasons. This is yet now another reason why I feel I don't want those things. But what percentage, what's the most sensitive, or what's the sensitivity rather, I guess, of using the transonic device for measuring the clot burden? In other words, when do you start seeing really a difference?
From bench testing, they can put precise amounts of solids into an oxygenator and compare it. The advertised accuracy is within 10%, but that's a very conservatively high percentage. It'll read a lot tighter than that.
Really? So feel pretty confident in the device. And of course, I'm really also fascinated with the end tidal CO2. Let me just ask you, do you think we should be using TCD on all ECMO patients as a routine standard of care, continuously?
It's interesting you say that. Most of the Dopplers you see are only instantaneous. Like the one I showed you, that was just, I think, a 30-second reading. They do have continuous ones. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that would I think that they, Dr. Cho, whatever his results come up to be, I think it's going to be a groundbreaking study.
Yeah.
Because we don't get to see what's going through the brain.
That's right.
We don't really get to see what's going through the circuit.
Well, it's not just and it's not just the
it's not just the
clot. It's the right, but not right, but not also yes, but yeah. It's true. But I mean, it's a big deal. But it's not just the clot worrying about embolic events, but flow. Mm-hmm. It validates so much because if you're not perfusing the brain, it doesn't matter what else you're perfusing. Mm-hmm. I think. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. You know. So I don't know. That's my feeling. Let's go on down. Questions, Miss Katie Kim?
Yes, I was wondering, does it measure the volume that's moving through the oxygenator or measuring the volume of the clot itself?
It's by deduction, you know the clot. It's measuring when the saline goes in to when it leaves. So if you fill up some of that space, then it's not liquid anymore. Mm-hmm. So a 250cc oxygenator, if there's 30 cc's of clot, well, then it's going to go through that much faster.
Okay, so it's measuring speed.
It's low tech. It'll read it'll read the volume directly.
So is it reading velocity? Is it just reading transit time? I mean, what is it actually measuring?
It's measuring all the flow between time zero and when the different wavelength fluid saline goes through the sensor.
So you say all the flow, you mean the volume of fluid?
Yes, that the saline bolus goes in and dilutes evenly pretty quickly. Certainly after filtering through an oxygenator, it's going to be well filtered, but still in bolus form.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you put it farther down the tubing or whatever, you would have a wider, flatter curve, but it'll still pick up however many cc's are going through it.
Gotcha.
I have a follow-up to that. So the problems that you see with measuring pressure, I think your point was pretty, pretty shocking. Depending on where the clot is, that you could have no pressure changes at all. So do you have the same sort of concerns with depending on where the clot is, or it doesn't matter because any part of it that is clotted is going to have the same typical effect on your saline bolus?
Yeah, depending on the degree of how evenly it forms. If you remember the first one I had, it was the only one I saw like that. It's just a smooth, even pad, a soft clot. Right. And the pressure climbed, and I thought, wow, that's very nice. That was about the only one I ever saw like that. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of the more progressive units that I've talked to that are actually rinsing them out, it's more of an anomaly than normalcy. So the nice precision linear rise is not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. But with the dilution measurement, you're going to have a response of that there's clot no matter how the clot is positioned, where it's even or it's in the corners, or that's kind of what I was trying to get at. Is that correct?
Oh. Yeah, good question. No, you're exactly right. The bolus filters through the fluid, and then it doesn't matter what corners it hides in, it'll read the volume accurately.
That's been consumed or that is no longer there.
Right, not available.
The liquid volume that's no longer there, right, available exactly. Because of the clot.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Good question. Now that makes good sense to me. You know, and I think that's scary because it's on the arterial side. Yeah. And we think, you know, it doesn't get there, but clearly it does. Yeah. And I think those pictures were frightening to me.
Yeah, good pictures.
They were great.
I mean, they were frightening to me.
Yeah.
Mike, questions?
Yeah, it's interesting. As we do a fair amount of ECMO with our team here in Houston, both VA and VV. Our indication for changing out the oxygenator is not so much based upon a clot, and let me just leave you with that thought for just a second. It's much more based upon whether or not we're getting circuit gases that look decent enough to continue to provide support to the patient. And longer it goes, the CO2 tends to build up. Is that what we're seeing is clot, or is that what we're seeing? And in essence, we are still basically changing out our oxygenator because of the clot level, or because somehow there's maybe a protein layer laid down that is causing them to go down. We run our ACTs a little bit lower. We have one doc who I think would run them without heparin if he could. And but we run our ACTs 160 to 180. But I don't think within this panel that we've ever changed out an oxidator because we saw a visible clot. It's because of CO2 retention in the patient. So is that what we're seeing, Roger?
Well, you raise a good point. The acid test would always be if it's failing to oxygenate or equalize what you need the blood gases to be, yeah, it's not performing anymore. But are we doing damage waiting for that ultimate late point to happen?
Yeah,
we don't know.
And that's
that.
A really good question. But I think to your point, if I can elaborate on that too, it's a really good point. Is by if we were to measure, even though I think this end-tidal CO2 is a great idea, and I think that that's what happens. It's inverse. Mm-hmm. The patient's CO2 is climbing mm-hmm. because our ability to remove the CO2 right. has gone down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's secondary, I think, to the obstruction or to the, you know, to the lack of surface area for ventilation, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why we see that. Nevertheless, I think if you just use that methodology, then you still don't really know what the reason is. And I think the only way to differentially diagnose mm-hmm. it being clot versus being just some kind of lipid or protein layer that's clogging the microporous portion of the oxygenator, if it's that versus clot, the only way to do that is the dilutional method. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, would tell us. So right. if you had mm-hmm. a situation where you were seeing, you know, hypercapnia occurring in the patient and you can't get the CO2 cleared, and that would be, to me, the time, let's test this right now.
Right.
First, let's do an end-tidal CO2. It's low, mm-hmm. so I know there's something wrong. It's not that the patient's metabolically hypermetabolic and they're right. producing just too much CO2. And then the next step would be do this, and if there's a volume change that's significant, well, the lung is clotting.
Right.
That's the reason. If it's not, then it may be a different reason, and you may be able to tease through it. But that's the only way to absolutely say it is or it isn't a problem that is you have a reduction in surface area from something solid.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can think of that's going to be solid in there, if it's because I don't think any of us are squirting silicone in it during the case. Look, I've done that. I haven't tried that. I haven't done that in a while. That's got to be clot.
Right.
Does that make sense, Roger? I probably said it. I probably was rather long-winded, but I was thinking it through.
That's right on. Right on target.
I think in a way, you know, clot probably doesn't transfer oxygen and CO2 very well.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't transfer it at all.
Right. So yeah. You know, I mean, if whether it's clot or if it's a platelet layer or a protein layer or a problem with our oxygen transfer, we're going to change the oxygenator either way.
Yeah, but sometimes you how many times have you teased through it and said,
yeah, because we're going
to
like,
but we'll get it. You turn the sweep up to right. 10 right. or 12 or whatever, and we just say, let's try to make it one more day.
Right.
Well, if you had done this test and found out that 80% of or 70% or 65% of your oxygenator was filled with clot, would you wait?
No.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah, because you're thinking about not what's in the oxygenator, but what made it through the oxygenator.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And that we don't know because we're not measuring TCD. Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So yes. I think once you get to 20% of clot burden, I think, or I don't know what that number is. Yeah. I just threw that number out there. I really don't know what the number would be, but in my mind, opinion, once you reach 20% of clot burden, you're trending a direction that is going to increase over time, your risk of thrombus embolus through your arterial circulation. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I think.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. So where do you live?
Near Syracuse.
Okay, well, I mean, there are flights down here from there.
yeah, they have their airport and everything.
Yeah, so we're just gonna have to get you back down here, I think, to give the talk the on the dilution, because I really enjoyed this talk. Mm-hmm. Despite all of the difficulties, I still think it was great. And you're obviously, I mean, you really know this topic extremely well. And we just want to hear more from you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Sure.
I've actually got another.
Oh, you have another question, please.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm so sorry.
It's not even really a question, but I think, you know, are you doing mostly pediatrics with your ECMO, or is it adults as well?
Well, I was a clinical specialist, so I was in whatever units wanted to invite me in. Okay. Most of them are pediatric, but there's a lot of adult ECMO going on out there with the same problems.
Okay. So there's something that we, you know, as our group here in Houston, when we're working, when we change out an oxygenator, when we make that decision to do it, that the patient will survive that and that it's time to do that. And, you know, we're going to be staying on long enough that we should go ahead and make that investment. We see an immediate, really, and Joe, you've seen this a lot too, like a really big improvement quickly on the patient. And one thing that Joe and I have talked about is you've mentioned that you think that there's something in the oxygenator when you put a new one in that it's somehow absorbing the
adsorbing, yes.
Absorbing.
Adsorbing, yeah.
The inflammatory.
The evil humors.
Either evil humors.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you see that, or have you seen that much when the oxygenator is changed out? Is this something that, how much of it is just a new oxygenator, and how much of it is the oxygenator actually acting as a kind of a filter almost, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good question. The rule of thumb I'd always learned and saw was once you change out an oxygenator, another reason you want to prolong that is because the subsequent change outs kind of fall by half. So if the first one changes in a week or 8 days, you're going to need another change out in about 4 days. You know, rough rule of thumb, not always true, but that's another reason you want to prolong that. To your point, what I'm thinking is whatever's going on isn't just going on in the oxygenator, it's going on in the patient. So whatever chemistry is causing the oxygenator fail, that's only part of the circulation. As soon as you change out that little piece of it, then all the poisons are still in the building and are going to contaminate, if you will, whatever's the new oxygenator is going to get bit by the same bug.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a good point too. But I think I understand your question. And if I can sort of add to it, maybe this will get you thinking in the same direction, Roger. So, you know, have you done much work or reading on plasma adsorption therapy or hemopurification, where they use those big plasma filters and they run it through like a charcoal media with various different charges on it to try to remove the protein bound inflammatory mediators? Have you seen much of that, like the MARS system, molecular adsorption therapy stuff?
No, I'm not firsthand familiar with that. No.
Okay. So basically I think what we see is that we have a patient who's been on ECMO for 5 days. They look okay. You know, they might have been septic, or they may still be septic, but they look okay, but they don't look great. And the oxygenator is kind of starting to degrade, and we just make the decision we're going to go ahead and change the oxygenator now. So we change it. And as soon as we do, the patient just seems to look better. You know, after it takes a little bit of time, you know, maybe an hour or so of being on the new oxygenator, maybe 2 hours, and they kind of start to perk up a little bit. Now, that doesn't last. They kind of just kind of eventually kind of go back. And there are filters out there that are made of various different materials. There's polysulfone and there's some kind of polypropylene. It's called M69, but I can't remember what it is. But there's all various different kinds that are designed to have inflammatory mediators adsorb or stick to them to remove them. And you run these filters until they clog up, not clot, and then change them. And you use that as your clearance of all these evil humors. And an oxygenator has a whole lot more surface area than do these little filters I'm referring to. So the hypothesis is that when we change the oxygenator, we sort of clear a portion or enough of a portion of the circulating inflammatory mediators onto the oxygenator, and that's why they look better, but then kind of trend back down to where they were over time. Is that kind of what we're saying?
Sure, I'd forgotten about the other technology you were telling me about, but yes, that is definitely right on.
So do you see, have you seen that in your practice?
No, or no, your experience? That's very interesting. Yeah. Hmm.
No, okay, so you haven't seen it. Now, the other thing is, to the point, and I understand your change out's a half and all that stuff. Of course, I believe in changing the oxygenator and circuit and everything else at 5 days, whether it needs it or not. But that's based more on what I recognize. And I may be onto something for the wrong reason. I'm not sure. But based on everything you told us today, I strongly suspect that changing the oxygenator, even one that has extended durability with the PMP fibers and stuff, probably should be changed because there's more clot burden in it than we ever really realized. Mm-hmm. But especially if it's a square oxygenator, but a rectangular oxygenator, I understand, or cylindrical rather, has the same potential in maybe fewer areas, but it still exists, is these dead spaces, these spaces of low velocity, where you're going to have clot develop. And so if you have a patient who's septic and you get clot in the corners or you get clot in the various ridges of a cylindrical oxygenator, it's going to be infected clot that cannot be treated. So you're treating the patient with antibiotics, and yet you have this ECMO circuit on day 8, day 9, day 10, day 11, day 12 that has this clot in it that's infected, so you never really clear the infection from the patient because you just keep giving it back to them. And so I believe, like, nurses change your IV lines every 48 hours or 72 hours.
Well, if it's a central line, it's usually 7 days.
Every seven central line, 7 days. Mm-hmm. So, but your normal IVs, you change every 48 hours. So split the difference and say 5 days, maybe we could say 7 days. I feel like it just needs to be changed. I don't think you should leave a circuit with all of that potential for having stagnant, now coagulated blood in it for 20 days. I think, to me, that makes no sense. For the reasons of infection, not necessarily for the reasons of the clot, but now after this discussion and incredibly good, great lecture, I think that I'm onto something, but for a different reason, because based on what he's telling us, I think we have a whole lot more clot than we ever imagined. Mm-hmm. We just simply don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good idea from the standpoint of, you know, changing out a whole circuit. If you've got a lot of inflammatory response mediators floating through, then the more of the circulating volume you replace, the less of it would be retained.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. That's what I think anyway.
Mm. So,
does that scare you? Are you reconsidering whether you want to move down here or not based on all of that?
No, not at all. I love this stuff.
All right. Well, come on down. Okay. You can do this all the time. All right. Anybody else have any further questions, comments? Roger, would you like to make any final comment? If you want, because I've still got to give my talk, and we'll have an open discussion later. You're welcome to call in or re-Skype in if you want, or it's just in deference to your time. I thought we'd have this discussion now. We're sort of off schedule, but we had those other issues. So I don't want to keep you longer than you need to be kept. And I just appreciate so much your generous time, but you're always welcome to listen in your car, call in, whatever you want on my next talk.
Well, that's great. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you too, Roger. Good talking to you. I'll give you a call back later on this evening too, if it's okay.
That's fine. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Roger. Thank you, sir.